Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Medicine. I am your host, Jeremy Corr. Today, we will be talking to Thomas Morris. He is here today to talk about his fascinating book, The Matter of the Heart, A History of the Heart in 11 Operations. Tom, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks very much.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Yes. Well, I started off my career working for the BBC, for BBC Radio, where I worked for 18 years. I was a producer on BBC Radio 4, which is the national speech network. And initially, I worked in arts programming, so programs about really everything from films, literature, plays, and everything else in the arts world. After a few years of doing that, I moved around a bit. I've been a documentary maker, and I worked on a program called In Our Time with Melvin Bragg, which I produced for 5 years. And that's a program about the history of ideas in the broadest sense. In fact, it's quite a successful podcast as well. So it does everything from medieval history to particle physics. It was a really interesting sort of second education, if you like, because you'd learn about cutting-edge chemistry and biology and astronomy, as well as filling in little holes in your historical knowledge. So I did that for 5 years. And then 3 years ago, I decided to leave the BBC and to start writing. And so this book is the first product of that sort of post-BBC life.
So what drew you specifically to this subject matter and ultimately inspired you to write this book?
Well, I've been interested in the subject of heart surgery for a good long time, about 15 years, if not longer. I think the first moment I got interested in it was a documentary that was on BBC TV some years ago. And it followed one of the major figures in the book, a surgeon called Michael DeBakey, who was at in Houston. At Methodist Hospital there. And he had an incredibly long career. He started working as a surgeon in the 1940s. And this documentary was filmed in the 1990s when, at the age of 89, he was still able to go into an operating theatre. He flew to Russia even after that to advise on the heart surgery that Boris Yeltsin, then the president, underwent. So he had this incredibly long career. And at the age of 89, he was the co-inventor of a new type of a pump, an implantable blood pump that could be used to assist a failing heart. And I found this absolutely fascinating. I mean, the idea that a man who was almost 90 was still performing advanced heart surgery, and the fact that he'd had this incredible career, which had begun in the days before anybody called themselves a heart surgeon. I mean, there was no such discipline in the 1940s when he was already operating as a kind of head, as a chief of surgery. So he was there all the way through the emergence of the discipline and then its development into something that could routinely save lives. And that was the moment I got interested in it. And then much later, in fact, I wrote an article about him for one of the newspapers here some years later. And when I looked into the middle period of his career, in particular, I discovered that there were just all these amazing stories about the people involved and what they did in order to create the discipline of heart surgery. And I found there wasn't actually the book I wanted to read didn't exist. So I thought there was an opportunity to write a book that was what I had been looking for when I first got interested in the subject, which is how I came to write it.
Your book flows in a way that each chapter is a different, you know, major milestone in progress and improvement in heart surgery. The first milestone in your books takes place during World War II. In 1945, Dwight Harkin removed a piece of shrapnel from the beating heart of Leroy Rohrbach. Can you talk about this and share its significance with our listeners?
Yes, that first operation is it's slightly different from the others I've chosen in that it's not the significance of that particular operation that's important, as the fact that it was one of a long series. What happened was this: nobody thought that it was possible to operate on the heart until the 1890s. For most of the 19th century, even long after surgeons had started to operate on the other organs of the body, they thought that the heart was just too difficult to operate on, partly because of where it is inside the body. It's inside the rib cage. It's very difficult to get to it from a practical point of view, but also because it was thought to be uniquely fragile, that if you were to even touch it, there was a risk that it would stop beating. So, it took a long time for surgeons to come anywhere near it. And the first operation on the heart took place in 1896. It was a German surgeon called Ludwig Rehn. And he did quite a simple operation. He stitched up, sutured a small stab wound in the heart of a man who'd been simply been stabbed. He was the third surgeon to attempt it, but the first to succeed. And after that, for at least 30 years of heart surgery, all the operations that took place were simply doing that. They were repairing injuries. And there were some bullets taken out of hearts in the First World War. That's not a very well-known fact. In fact, a couple of them took place using local anesthetic. So you had a patient who was actually conscious while a surgeon was opening up their chest and taking out a bullet or a fragment of shrapnel. And wow, the big change happened. I mean, this was basically a wartime occupation. You only really got any gunshot wounds in any large volumes during the First World War and then the Second World War. So when the Second World War began, there were a few surgeons who knew that it was possible to take bullets out of the heart or pieces of fragments of metal. And in 1944, the American military set up a massive field hospital in Gloucestershire in England. And it was preparation for D-Day, because they realized that as soon as there were Allied troops storming the beaches of northern France, they would need advanced medical facilities to deal with all the casualties that were likely to come back. So they built this huge field hospital in Gloucestershire at a place called Stowell Park. And it was a specialist chest surgery hospital, a thoracic facility. And Dwight Harkin was a young surgeon. He was in his early 30s. And he had a particular interest in thoracic surgery. He trained with the leading chest surgeon in London, a man called Tudor Edwards. And he was appointed because he knew the country, but also had the greatest expertise of anybody of his generation of American surgeons. And in an operating theatre that was, it was basically a Nissen hut. It was a small tin shack in a field. He operated on dozens and dozens of American soldiers who'd come back with chest wounds without a single death. That is what is most incredible about that operation. None of his patients died. I think it's about 144 patients he had. A large number of those had shrapnel actually inside the cardiac chambers, and he saved them all without a single death.
That's incredible. In 1944, Alfred Blalock gained celebrity status for himself and made Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore a pilgrimage destination for the parents suffering of children suffering from tetralogy of Fallot, otherwise known as blue babies. Can you tell us about his work with these blue babies?
Yes, and this is a great collaboration actually between three people. It's one of the most common congenital disorders of the heart. It's called tetralogy of Fallot, as you said, and it's four. So the word tetralogy is actually something of a misnomer, but it's four separate problems, and it's a complex condition, and it's also one of the most common problems that can go wrong with the heart. And these children were very, very unwell. It's called blue baby syndrome because the blood going around their body has not been properly oxygenated. It's not only a small proportion of it has actually been through the lungs before it's pumped around the body. So their skin gets this kind of bluish tinge. And there's a very high mortality rate in infancy. A lot of surgeons had been very keen to do something about it, but it was generally thought to be inoperable. And Alfred Blalock had a colleague called Helen Tausig, who was a great pediatric cardiologist. And she'd noticed something in another condition that babies sometimes have, which is called a patent ductus, which is where a hole between two of the major blood vessels just above the heart allows blood to go between them. And she realized that if there was some way of doing basically what you might think of as a bit of plumbing around the heart, using a blood vessel to bypass part of the circulation, you might get more blood going back to the lungs and therefore more oxygenation, and these babies might do a bit better. And she suggested it to Alfred Blalock, who was receptive to the idea, but he then got the third person involved, and that was Vivian Thomas. Now, he had a very interesting background. He was a technician who'd worked with Blalock in his previous job, and he'd originally wanted to be a doctor, but he lost all his savings in the Great Depression. The bank he'd saved his savings in went bust. And he was also black. He's an African-American, and at the previous hospital he'd been employed at, although he was a highly skilled lab technician, he was paid as a janitor simply because he wasn't white. And he was told about this, and he developed the operation. So it's now known generally as the Blalock-Tausig shunt, or the Blalock-Tausig operation. But there's a good case for saying it should actually be called the Blalock-Tausig-Thomas shunt. And it involved it was a very delicate operation because there were very small children they were operating on initially. and the first one took place in 1944 in Johns Hopkins. It involved basically dissecting away a small artery and then attaching it to one of the arteries that takes blood up to the lungs. That's why it's called a shunt. It's because it shunts blood from one part of the circulation to the other. And it's the first time that any operation had been invented that could actually alleviate the symptoms. It wasn't a cure, but it's the first time that anybody had succeeded in alleviating the symptoms of tetralogy of Fallot.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned in the book that it made it a pilgrimage destination for many parents who had children suffering from that.
They had thousands of patients. They called them tets. So the tetralogy patients were known to the staff as tets. But they had thousands besieging them. Local newspapers would raise the funds to send the local tetralogy baby to be operated on by Blaylock. They had all the wards and corridors taken over by these children. I can't remember the exact figure, but they operated on something like 5,000 in the first 4 or 5 years. It was a really incredible number of children. And eventually, Blaylock went on a sort of tour of Europe to teach other surgeons the operation. Because in the first year, they were overwhelmed with patients from all over America. And then after that, they started to get them from abroad as well. And he was invited over by one of the leading surgeons in London. And he did a sort of residency at Guy's Hospital here in London. And he taught some surgeons how to do it here. He also did the same in France and I believe in Sweden. So once that knowledge had escaped, then other surgeons could do it, and it was less of a problem for him. But it was an interesting example, I think, of how surgical knowledge spreads.
So in 1952, an aortic aneurysm was considered to be fatal, like cancer. Yet in early 1953, Michael Debakey made what was to date the greatest achievement in vascular surgery. Can you please talk about this for our listeners?
Sure. Well, an aortic aneurysm is the aorta is the largest artery in the body. It takes blood from the heart, from the left ventricle of the heart, to essentially the rest of the body. The aorta is a sort of the aortic arch is a structure just above the heart. The artery curves around in this sort of graceful loop and then goes down sort of along the spine, right down past the kidneys, and distributes blood to the lower half of the body. And an aneurysm is where you get a sort of ballooning of this artery, where there's a weakness in the wall of the vessel, and blood pressure is at great pressure, particularly in the upper part of the aorta. It pushes this weakness out, and this is incredibly dangerous because it can, first of all, swell and enlarge, and then it can burst. And if it bursts, that's it, because it pumps out huge amounts of blood, and the patient will generally die within a matter of minutes or hours. And this is a big problem for a surgeon because there was really no effective way of treating it. There are plenty of slightly horrible accounts of what used to happen to patients before surgery was possible. The aneurysmal sac, the swelling, would sometimes kind of erode the ribs and appear through the front of the rib cage, and you'd have this sort of squashy mass at the front of the chest, and the patient and the doctors were just sadly waiting for it to burst. And what Debakey did, he and Denton Cooley, who was his slightly younger colleague, they weren't, I don't think, the first to do any of this, but they were the first, again, to turn it into a routine and safe treatment. They worked out, first of all, how to resect, that is to cut out the diseased section of the blood vessel, and how to tie the ends together, as it were. But Debakey, in particular, realized that it would be possible to make a graft to join the two ends together, an artificial section of blood vessel. And what he did was he went to a department store. He was trying to get some nylon, which he thought would be a good material for making these grafts, and they didn't have any in stock. But the woman behind the counter said, well, I've got this other material which is new. We haven't had it before. It's called Dacron, and you might find that's as good. And he made the first grafts on his wife's sewing machine. He just cut out a strip of this material and then sewed the sides together and ended up with a kind of rough and ready tube. And then he sewed it in between the two cut ends of the artery So having cut out the aneurysm, he interposed this graft in between. And it turns out the Dacron was incredibly good for this purpose, because you'd get new cells, new tissue would be laid down on the inside. So what you'd effectively have there is the scaffolding for a new section of blood vessel. And that is the first time that anybody had created an artificial substitute for an artery, and one that was effective in the long term.
So before 1953, one of the major obstacles preventing lengthy major heart surgery was the issue of how to supply oxygen to the vital organs. Circulation only has to be interrupted for 2 minutes before the onset of brain damage and 6 minutes before death. Can you please tell us about the first successful use of John Gibbons' heart-lung machine and some of the other things that people were attempting to overcome this issue at the same time?
Yes, I think this is one of the most fascinating, and it shows the highest degree of ingenuity, I think, arguably, in the history of heart surgery. So you stated the problem there. If you stop the heart because you want to operate on it, if you take it out of the circulation, you have only minutes before the organs start to die from lack of oxygen. So you need to find some way either of supplying them with oxygen, with blood, all the way through the operation, or you need to find a way to reduce their oxygen needs. And there were actually three successful solutions to this problem. And I'll come to the heart-lung machine last. The first successful method was hypothermia, and several surgeons used this with great success. The idea was that if you chill the body to quite a considerable degree, so normal body temperature is about 37 degrees Celsius, and if you chill it to the low 20s, you greatly reduce the tissue's need for oxygen. Which is why, incidentally, if somebody's been underwater in very cold water, they can survive for longer if the water was very cold than if it was at body temperatures, because the oxygen hunger of their tissues has been reduced by the temperature of the water. Mm-hmm. And several surgeons used this very successfully to perform heart surgery. It was nerve shredding, because you might get 12 minutes using hypothermia if you chilled the whole body. You might get 12 minutes to operate on the heart, but you had no longer than that. So you had to start and finish the operation within those 12 minutes. Otherwise, your patient might start going into brain damage. The other means of getting a patient in open heart surgery was called cross-circulation. And this was a great surgeon in Minnesota called Seward and Lillehei. One of his colleagues suggested the idea to him, and he was the only one brave enough, or rash, some of his colleagues thought, to actually go through with it. And cross-circulation was the idea that if you're going to stop your patient's heart, they need blood circulating through their body somehow. But why not use another person to circulate the blood for them? And what he was doing was surgery for congenital disorders on children. And he realized that if a parent had the same blood type as the child, you could simply hook up the parent's circulation to the child's. So for the period of the operation, you would have two patients anesthetized on tables side by side. You'd have the parent and then the child, and the parent's blood vessels would be attached to the child's. So the parent was effectively breathing and pumping blood for two people just for the duration of that operation. Now, that sounds horribly dangerous, and one of his colleagues said it was the only known operation with a potential 200% mortality rate. But in fact, he was such a great surgeon that they had enormous success with it. Not a single donor was harmed. Not all the operations were successful, but there are still people alive today who, as children, were operated on using cross-circulation in the mid-1950s, which I think is incredible testament to what a great surgeon he was and how well he'd thought through the risks.
Yeah, there's an absolutely fascinating photo of that in your book as well.
It's incredible, isn't it? It's not often you see two patients in an operating theater lying side by side with teams looking after both of them. But these were kind of sideshows. I mean, hypothermia pure hyperthermia on its own was only used for 5 or 10 years at the most. It's still now incorporated into surgery, but as an adjunct to other techniques. Cross-circulation was only ever performed successfully by one surgeon. It's thought that there were several other surgeons who gave it a go, but they quietly dropped all reference to it from their work because it wasn't nearly as successful as Zillahi had done it. But what actually won out in the end was the third possibility, which is using an entirely artificial circulation, the heart-lung machine, as we call it now. And John Gibbon was the first to make it work. He was not the only one working on the problem at the time. But he was the first to take it seriously, was working on the idea from the 1930s. The only other person who was doing it at that period was in Russia, and his work did not become well-known here until the 1960s. But Gibbon was working on cats initially from the 1930s onwards, and what he did was develop a pump, a very simple pump, which simply sort of impelled blood through plastic tubing using sort of fingers to sweep the blood through. And the important bit was an artificial oxygenator, which took the place of the lungs while the patient was in surgery. And for that, he used a sort of screen of wire mesh. And the blood, which had been removed from the patient's circulation, was trickled down this wire mesh in an atmosphere of pure oxygen. And this allowed gas exchange to take place. So carbon dioxide came out of the red blood cells as they trickled down the mesh, and oxygen went was bound to the hemoglobin inside. So you would refresh the blood. It was refreshed with more oxygen, which could then be pumped straight into the patient. And that allowed him long enough to operate on patients. He only actually used it three times. His first operation was a success. The child survived and did well. But then the next two died, and he was so devastated by this that he thought he really couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah, I thought that was a very fascinating part of the book, that after that he just kind of stepped away from it.
Yes, the reasons for why he did that, I think, they're not entirely clear. People have differing opinions on it. The easy interpretation, the obvious interpretation, is that he just couldn't take it when his patients died, and he'd lost 2/3 of his first three patients. You know, more than half had died, and that was just emotionally too much for him to take. Another possibility is simply that he thought he'd done his bit, and having got it, the technology, to the stage it was at, he decided he wanted to move on and do something else.
In 1960, newspapers everywhere had the front page headline of "Heart Valve Replaced by Rubber Ball." You said in your book, repairing or replacing heart valves was one of the most intractable medical problems of the 20th century. Can you please tell us about this and Albert Starr's use of the device designed by the retired engineer Lowell Edwards?
Sure. Heart valve disease was one of the biggest killers 100 years ago. And the reason for this is that there is a disease which is not well known in the developed world these days, but which was pretty much ubiquitous until the early part of the 20th century, and that is rheumatic fever. Rheumatic fever is it's a bacterial infection. It's the streptococcus infection, and it's a complication essentially. It's an immune response to the original infection, and it can cause all sorts of secondary effects, one of which is endocarditis, infection on the inside parts of the heart, but particularly the valves. There were hundreds of thousands of people suffering with this, certainly in London in the latter part of the 19th century, early 20th century. So this was a major problem for doctors, and there was really nothing they could do. There were a few attempts to operate on the heart valves from the 1920s on. Elliot Cutler, who's a surgeon from America, and also Henry Souter, who was a London surgeon, both made attempts to treat a condition called mitral stenosis, which is where the valve becomes constricted, and so not enough blood is traveling through it. Then both of them tried to open up the valve opening by inserting a knife or a scalpel It through the side of the heart and just sort of notching the valve leaflets to let more blood flow through. But these attempts weren't terribly successful. And what a lot of surgeons really wanted was a replacement valve. There was a lot of work done on this problem from the 1940s onwards. There were There were even sort of international conferences devoted to artificial heart valves even before the first successful operation had taken place. And actually, one of these conferences took place in the late summer of 1960 in Chicago, or near Chicago. And Albert Starr was there. He was a young cardiac surgeon at the time, and he'd been approached by an elderly engineer, Lowell Edwards, who you mentioned, who had had quite a successful career already. I mean, he was at retirement age. He might have done nothing more with his life. He'd already made quite a lot of money. He'd designed machines for stripping bark from logs. He'd also designed a fuel pump, which was used widely by the US Air Force in the Second World War. And the royalties, the payments he got as a result of that invention alone were enough to fund his retirement quite comfortably. But he got obsessed with the idea of designing something that would be medically useful. And what he originally wanted to do was design an artificial heart. He thought it was a problem that he could maybe solve. And he went to see Starr, who was a good 30 years younger than him, and explained what he was thinking of doing. And Albert Starr said, "Well, it's a great idea, but I think it's very difficult because we don't even have a valve. Why don't we turn our attention to that instead?" So the two of them got together, and over the course of actually barely more than a couple of years, they had a successful prototype, which they tested in dogs. And eventually in 1960, they implanted it for the first time into a patient. And they got lucky. I mean, a lot of surgeons who I've mentioned in the book, when they tried to do something for the first time, it went wrong. And they might do it half a dozen times before they made it work. And in the case of the Starr Edwards valve, the first implantation worked perfectly. The patient lived for another decade. In fact, he only died because of a domestic accident, nothing to do with his heart at all. And that was it. That was the artificial heart valve successfully launched.
Would you please tell us a little bit about the history, invention, and early use of both defibrillators and pacemakers?
Yes, these are both interesting inventions in that they were both conceived, constructed, and forgotten about more than once. They each have about three or four inventors. Mm-hmm. I think I should explain. I've been talking mainly so far about the mechanical properties of the heart. This is a muscular organ that contracts. It's in some ways, it's like thinking about plumbing. You know, you've got pipes and a pump to propel the blood around the body. But it's also an electrical organism, an electrical organ, rather, in that its control circuits, if you like, are all actuated by electricity. Some hearts don't have a structural problem with them, but the heartbeat, the rhythm of the heart, has been disturbed one reason or another. And it was in the very early part of the 20th century that physicians realized that that the electrical activity of the heart was important as well. That's what made the heart beat. The pacemaker first came into life in the early part of the 20th century in Australia, which was not known at the time as a centre of excellence for surgery. It was a doctor called Mark Lidwell, and he had noticed that sometimes when he was treating patients, he was actually at the time he was working in an obstetrical an obstetric hospital, and sometimes children were born without a heartbeat, and he was desperate to find a way of restarting the heart because these children were these were not children who were obviously about to die, but they were, if they were unlucky enough to be born, to be starved of oxygen and to be born without a heartbeat, there was nothing they could do for them. And he rigged up what was actually quite a simple apparatus, which just sent pulses of electricity through a needle. And he attached the needle to, he just simply poked the needle into the heart muscle and these electrical impulses would start up the heart. But at some point, and it's not clear why, he just abandoned this research after a couple of years. His collaborator seems to have left the hospital he was working at, and then he was on his own and didn't really feel like pursuing it. It was then reinvented, this invention, a good 10 years later in America by Albert Hyman. It's not clear whether he actually knew of Lidwell's work, but he invented a very similar device, again, people really didn't take very much notice of it. They were rather skeptical. He wasn't helped by the fact that a lot of newspapers essentially thought that he was reviving people from the dead. So he used to get hate mail from clergymen and so on, suggesting that he was tampering with nature and the divine plan. So he was regarded as a bit of a maverick, and again ignored, and his research basically petered out into nothing. And then the idea of the pacemaker was only really thought of again in the 1950s, and that's when you can identify at least five or six people who have a good claim to be described as the inventor of the pacemaker. I'm not going to name them all because there are just so many of them. But you have various different sorts of pacemaker all being invented simultaneously in the 50s and the 60s. The first implantable pacemaker came along in 1960. It was implanted in Sweden. But yes, from 1960, these were small enough to be fully implanted in the human body with their own battery pack. And at that point, it became something that was not merely a piece of hospital equipment, but something that could actually give somebody who had a serious heart arrhythmia that was impairing their quality of life, gave them the ability to walk around again and live a normal life.
In 1967, Renier Favolaro performed the first successful coronary artery bypass graft as a treatment for coronary heart disease. Can you please talk to us about this for a little bit?
Yes. He wasn't actually the first, interestingly, although he is generally thought of as the pioneer who made it happen. And again, a bit like the first, the Stoell Park operation I mentioned, Dwight Harkin, he was the first person who did it consistently and in large numbers. The coronary arteries are the blood's own heart supply. So when the heart pumps, every time it contracts, the first muscle, the first tissue that benefits from each contraction is the heart's own muscle. And it has very large need for oxygen. It takes about a third of the total oxygen circulated within each heartbeat goes straight back into the heart muscle. And coronary artery disease is where the blood vessels become blocked by atheroma, which is essentially a sort of fatty deposit. And when that happens, the areas of heart muscle can be starved of oxygen, and you get, in the first instance, you get angina. It's called ischemia, this starving the heart muscle of oxygen. And angina, the chest pain associated with coronary artery disease. And then if it becomes severe enough and the blockage is serious, then it can turn into a myocardial infarction, otherwise known as a heart attack. So that's the problem. And it was about 30 years of development that led up to this operation in 1967. The essential problem is the heart muscle isn't getting enough blood. So how do you solve that? Several solutions were reached, none of them as good as a bypass operation. So one of them in the 1930s, and two different surgeons were involved in this, one in here in London and another in the States. You essentially attach part of another organ to the surface of the heart. So there was one surgeon who would suture part of the lung onto the surface of the heart, and another used the omentum, which is a sort of apron of, it's a sort of fatty membrane that sits in front of the abdominal organs. And these are both quite vascular structures. They've got a good blood supply. So the idea was that they would form new connections with the heart muscle, and that would slightly increase the oxygenation of the heart tissue. And it worked probably, but only to a small degree. And then various other solutions were reached to the problem. One was that you could take a blood vessel from elsewhere in the chest and you just sort of bury it in the muscle. And again, that brings new blood to the heart muscle, but not necessarily in the volumes you want. And what Favolaro did, he was an Argentinian who was then working in Cleveland, was it occurred to him that the best supply of blood in the body is the aorta. So what you needed to do was find some way of taking blood at that high pressure you find in the aorta straight into the coronary circulation. And the solution he hit on was using a length of vein from the patient's leg. It's called the saphenous vein. And you have to turn it I was about to say turned inside out. You have to reverse it because the veins have valves in them to stop reverse flow of blood. So you have to kind of turn it backwards. And then you attach it, stitch it between the aorta and the coronary circulation, the coronary arteries. And that just brings a new supply of high pressure blood straight from the aorta back towards the heart muscle. And unlike the other operations that had been invented to treat the condition, it's a quick fix. You get the results very quickly, within hours. And with the older operations they were trying, you would find that you would actually get new blood vessels forming in the heart muscle. And this is a process that takes months. So all the time that this process is going on, the patient would still be affected and at risk of dying from a secondary heart attack. Now, I said he wasn't quite the first. In fact, there were several surgeons, I think three surgeons, who got there before him. One was in Russia. It was a surgeon called Kolosov, I think. And another was in Houston, Edward Garrett, who was an assistant to Michael DeBakey. But he only did it as a sort of emergency measure, and he didn't write it up until years afterwards, so nobody knew he'd done it. But Favaloro was the person. He was working with one of the great, it was one of the Cleveland Clinic. It was not only one of the great surgical centers in the US, it was also a great diagnostic center. There was a man there called Mason Soans who invented several new methods of visualizing the structures around the heart, looking at what was going on in the coronary arteries. And he was really in the right place at the right time, Favaloro, because he had these colleagues with incredible specialized expertise. He could talk to about the problems, and then he could go off into the operating theater and try his new procedure. And he had hundreds of successful cases really before any other surgeons had accepted that the operation was a good one.
On December 3rd, 1967, a tragic car accident turned to medical miracle is now probably the most famous surgery in history. And Christian Bernard became the first surgeon to transplant a human heart. Can you please share this story with us?
Yes. Heart transplantation is something that surgeons have been thinking about since, well, with any seriousness, probably since the beginning of the 1950s. The idea had actually been first tried as long ago as, well, the first decade of the 20th century. By Alexis Carrel, who is a French emigre who worked in New York. But he was such a visionary that nobody really took it as a prediction of what would happen in the future, at least not in the short term. The research into transplantation didn't immediately focus on hearts. It was other organs were certainly easier to transplant, particularly kidneys. The first successful kidney transplant took place in the 1950s, performed by Joseph Murray, between identical twins. Now, the reason that detail is significant is that the biggest single handicap to transplanting an organ from one person to another, or in fact from one species into another, is nothing to do with the technical difficulty of attaching blood supply and that sort of thing. It's to do with the rejection problem, the fact that an immune system will recognize a donor organ as foreign and then try to destroy it. And when Joseph Murray became the first to perform a kidney transplant, his patient and the donor were genetically identical, as identical twins, so rejection wasn't a problem. The kidney was essentially recognized as the patient's own tissue. Now, with hearts, it wasn't until the early 1960s that surgeons really worked out that the technique was feasible. And I think the person who was really responsible more than any other for working out how the technique could be achieved was Norman Shumway, who really started transplantation almost as a sideline. He was doing experimental surgery on dogs, and they were using the heart-lung machine, really practicing. And they hit upon the idea of taking the heart out of the body, keeping the animal on the heart-lung machine, and then performing what they call desk surgery. So you take the heart out, you operate on it, and then put it back inside the dog. And while he and his collaborator, Richard Lower, were doing this, they realized that it was actually quite difficult to put the heart back in unless they took a longer length of blood vessel, because then they had more margin to work with, more material to sew. At that point, they realized it'd be easier if they had two dogs. And that's how he got interested in the idea of taking a heart out of one body and putting it into another. And that became a major research project for him. Now, the interesting thing is that the person who's become famous for the first human heart transplant, Christian Barnard, didn't get interested in the subject until very much later. We've just marked the 50th anniversary of this operation. It was December 1967. He really only got interested in the subject of transplantation a little more than a year before that, by which time Lower and Shumway they'd essentially worked out the details of the operation. They were trying to work on the problem of rejection, which was still pretty much insoluble as far as they were concerned. But they worked out the technical details. And Barnard, coming into this problem really late, got interested. He did one kidney transplant, which was actually a success. The patient lived for over a decade afterwards, I think. But that was only his only transplant operation before the pioneering operation in December 1967. So there were many people, particularly in the surgical world, who felt that he'd leapt into this area to grab the glory from those who deserved it, including Shumway.
In 1982, William DeVries had performed the first successful artificial heart transplant with the Javric 7. Yet issues, complications, and illness due to all that, the patient died a few months later. He had to endure professional and personal abuse, as well as tons of negative media. Cooley, who you mentioned earlier, was critical of him. And in fact, you know, criticism of these procedures is something that, you know, has been kind of, you know, in every chapter of the book almost. Can you please discuss this for us?
Yes, it's in a way it's still the most emotive and controversial area in heart surgery. I've had, just thinking about the artificial hearts are still with us. They are not a mainstream therapy because they are incredibly expensive, and they don't offer a great quality of life. But I've talked to surgeons who say, yeah, artificial hearts are here to stay. In fact, I talked to one who said, I've got two patients on an artificial heart at the moment in this hospital. They're, you know, an acceptable therapy. They work, they save lives. And then I've talked to others who roll their eyes and say, they shouldn't be used. They're, you know, an abomination. So that, although it's much less public than it used to be, that controversy rolls on in some degree. The problem with the artificial hearts, firstly, it's a really ferociously difficult engineering challenge to build a machine that replicates the functions of the human heart. Our hearts are, you wouldn't know it necessarily, but they're beautifully engineered mechanisms. They're self-regulating. They speed up when the body needs more oxygen, and they slow down when it's not needed. And they do all sorts of functions that an advanced engineer would really struggle to build into an automated system. And most importantly, they can never go wrong. I mean, if they go wrong once, that's the end of the story, generally speaking. So you don't have the luxury of it as an engineer of thinking, well, one malfunction in 5 years isn't bad, I'll build it to that specification. The other problem is that nobody has really succeeded in building a heart that is convenient. I mean, even the best now, they have a drive unit which is external to the body. So the implant is pumping blood around the body, but the motor powering that pump has to be carried outside the body. Now, the best models these days are in a backpack, so you do have some degree of mobility. But those old models in the early 1980s were terrible. They were huge, great drive units that looked like a washing machine or something. And the earliest patients had almost no mobility and very little quality of life. And they were plagued with clinical complications. So the first three or four patients all had very long episodes where they would go back into surgery to have some part of the pump removed and replaced. They were, in the words of Norman Shumway, in fact, the transplant pioneer, they were clot machines. These pumps would throw out little clots all over the body. The patients would suffer regular strokes. It was a very unpleasant business. And it took a good, I would say, 25 to 30 years for them to get significantly better in terms of quality of life and reliability. They are better now, I believe, but they are still a very controversial area.
On June 12th, 1986, Ulrich Segwart used the first ever stent, under very dramatic circumstances too, on a coronary artery preventing emergency bypass surgery. Can you please share this story with our listeners?
Sure. And this is, in some ways, it's an alternative approach to the problem that René Favaloro was trying to deal with, which is to say it was also coronary artery disease. And the backstory to this is that in the 1970s, we saw the advent of balloon angioplasty, and that was a German cardiologist called Andreas Grunzig came up with that idea, based on this rather brilliant American pioneer of the 1960s called Charles Dotter, and Charles Dotter invented a technique called transluminal angioplasty, and his idea was essentially like using a wire brush or something to clean out a drain. He was dealing with patients who had clots, typically in the large arteries in their legs, and he realized that if he could just push a catheter through these blockages, he could just clear a new channel and you could unblock the artery. So in patients who were close to losing their entire leg sometimes from gangrene because the blood flow was obstructed, he would push a catheter through the obstruction, restore blood flow, and they would be essentially cured. Now, Grunzig in the 1970s extended this concept to the tiny blood vessels of the heart. And by inserting a catheter through a blood vessel in the groin, and then carefully advancing the catheter until it went up through the aorta and then into the coronary vessels, he could inflate a tiny balloon and reopen the occluded vessel. And that was great because it meant that even after a heart attack, you could restore blood flow to the affected area of heart muscle and you get an alleviation of symptoms. And the only problem with this was that the blood vessels tended to close up again. You'd have sudden obstruction or reocclusion. And what they needed was some sort of structure to keep the blood vessel open once it had been, once the balloon had done its work. And so what Segwart did was to think, well, what can we use to keep this vessel open after the balloon has pushed it open? And he thought, well, actually a sort of scaffold is what's needed. And he designed a thing that's based on, there's a type of toy called a Chinese finger trap, which is like a sort of contracting circular cylindrical scaffold. And it was designed in such a way that it could just be snapped onto a balloon, just sort of inserted over this tiny balloon, which was then pushed in through the blood vessels towards the heart. And then once it was inside the coronary vessels, you'd inflate the balloon and the stent would just snap into place. And then you have a perfectly open vessel with a stent surrounding it and protecting it, preventing further reclosure. The first time he implanted it, he was giving a course in angioplasty, not stenting because that hadn't been done clinically yet. Well, it had, but only by one guy in France. He was giving this course in angioplasty, and there were a lot of visiting doctors there. And in front of this audience of consultants, he had a middle-aged woman who was being given balloon angioplasty. Everything was going fine, and he did this case with the patient. And the doctors who were there to watch him at work went off to the canteen to have their lunch. And as he was talking to the patient after the procedure, Segwart noticed that a kind of look of alarm went over her face. And he realized immediately what had happened. The vessel he had opened had immediately reclosed. It was as if it had just kind of collapsed upon itself and no blood was getting through to the heart muscle. So he got us straight back into the treatment room, and he decided this time he would insert a stent. So he inserted this catheter, this time with a stent rather than just a balloon, and pressed a button at the end of this catheter, and the stent went in. And when his colleagues got back from their lunch in the canteen, he told them all about the drama, which they'd missed. So I think they were all pretty annoyed. It was the first time he had been able to insert the stent device that he had invented.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty fascinating. On November 7th, 2005, at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, a stent was placed in a fetus with the heart the size of a grape while it was still in the uterus of the mother. It's 2017, and this is still mind-blowing to me, as are all the other procedures we've discussed, but the precision this one would require in particular is crazy. Can you tell us a bit about this?
Yes. This is for a condition called hypoplastic left heart syndrome. And this is one of the most difficult conditions today still for physicians and surgeons to treat, because essentially the heart is born without the left side, the most important side of the heart. It's kind of withered and small. And what you end up with is a heart that's barely able to function. And the kind of ins and outs of it are quite difficult to explain. But the one of the ways in which children are affected by it is that it affects them during the womb as well. It can damage their lungs because of the blood pressures essentially that are going through their circulation, even in the womb, are radically different from what they would be if they had a normal heart. So what they did in this case, it's only been done, I think, a few dozen times, because this is a rare condition and not every child with hypoplastic left heart syndrome will benefit from it. But it was preferable to create and maintain a communication between the left and the right sides of the heart. Now, this had been done before in the womb, but this is the first time that they also inserted a stent, a sort of scaffolding, to keep that hole open. There's a tendency for the hole to close up after surgery. The condition is sometimes, but sadly not always, diagnosed when the child is in the second or third trimester, so in pregnancy. And it's only if it's diagnosed at that stage that you have a chance of preventing the lung damage that often occurs. So yes, the procedure entailed essentially two patients in one, because you have the mother who also needs to be looked after during surgery at an advanced stage of pregnancy as well. You then have the unborn child. So this operation, on the occasions it's been done, you need two teams, essentially a team of anesthetists or anesthesiologists, for both a patient and for the fetus, and using a catheter, which is fed in through the abdominal wall of the mother, and then after that into the womb, and then very precisely through the chest of the fetus. And then once a guide wire has been put in through this kind of incredibly direct method, then a stent is fed through the hole, firstly in the mother's abdominal wall, then through her womb, and then into the child's chest, and then placed with breathtaking accuracy in the middle of the heart, which, as you say, is about the size of a grape.
That's insane. That's so crazy. You clearly did your homework while working on this book, and it's an amazing book. I am curious, though, what do you see as, you know, the next big major breakthrough in heart surgery?
Well, the interesting thing is that I don't see those breakthroughs, and I can only go on what I've been told by the real experts here. But those breakthroughs don't seem to be happening in surgery. Most of the surgeons I talked to had very little to say when I said, what's the next big thing in heart surgery? They didn't really know. They were generally talking about quite small improvements to existing techniques. Now, the area that is really exciting at the moment is interventional cardiology. And around 40 years ago, effectively, the discipline split into two. And surgeons are the people who cut you open and perform open heart surgery. And this new discipline has emerged, the interventional cardiologists, who do things using a catheter and a small incision in a vein. They are a vein or an artery. They're doing minimally invasive surgery. They're effectively surgeons, but they don't call themselves surgeons. And all the most exciting developments that people have told me about involve operating on heart valves or correcting congenital abnormalities using clever methods of getting instruments into the heart through a vein or an artery. So surgery without the it's surgery without the surgeon, if you like. It's not a scalpel, but a sort of length of wire, like a piece of spaghetti, to get inside the heart and operate on it. Just to give you an example of that, one of the most recent developments has been valve replacements called TAVI in this country, and TAVR in the US, which involves replacing the aortic valve, the valve just at the bottom of the aorta, entirely using a catheter. And more surgeons are doing valve replacement and repair operations. Sorry, I said surgeons, I meant cardiologists. They're doing valve operations and valve replacements through a catheter, and it takes away the need for surgery entirely. This is very exciting. Interventional cardiologists are really buzzing about what's happening next in their discipline. In a way, I think surgeons aren't.
Well, Tom, I've taken up a lot of your time today. My final question for you is, what are you working on now?
I'm just writing a book, which is coming out in the UK in October and in the US in November. It's called The Mystery of the Exploding Teeth. And it's a book about curiosities in medical history. So it's based on some of the amazing stories you find in old medical journals from, well, really the beginning of medical journals, which is kind of in the late 17th, early 18th century, and between then about 1900. And so these are kind of weird and wonderful stories of amazing injuries and unlikely cures, and the odd ways in which doctors used to treat their patients in the old days.
Wow, that sounds really, really interesting. Yeah. When it's finished, you'll have to let me know. I'd love to read it and have you back on the show to talk about it.
Sure, love to.
I want to thank you again for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it, and it was an absolute pleasure to speak with you. Take care.
Thank you very much.